This is an iHeart podcast. Guaranteed human.
Introducing B of A Rewards, a new way to reward your every ambition. It all starts with a Bank of America checking account and grows from there. You get cash back deals on brands you know and love, plus a credit card rewards bonus, helping you earn more rewards on things you buy every day. Join B of A Rewards today for rewards tailored to your lifestyle. What would you like the power to do? Bank of America. Open or enroll your account at bankofamerica.com/B of A Rewards. Bank of America Corporation, all rights reserved.
And now for a quick break from our sponsor, Vital Proteins. And it is vital. Collagen Peptides is a wellness supplement that supports healthy hair, skin, nails, bones, and joints. When we hit 30, our body's collagen production starts to drop. And that's when Vital Proteins steps in. Their iconic blue tub is everywhere. People love Vital Proteins, in part because it's so easy. Just mix it into your coffee, tea, or smoothie, and you're good to go. And now you can get 20% off your next order at vitalproteins.com by using promo code TECHSTUFF20 at checkout. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Hey there. Before this podcast continues, I need you to fill out 37 forms about your listening history. I'll wait. Just kidding. That would be ridiculous. Yet we all do it every time we need healthcare. But new Amazon Health AI is different. It can connect your health history to offer personalized care, so you can get help fast. Amazon Health AI. Healthcare just got less painful. I want to tell you about the new 2027 Kia Seltos, a midsize SUV that simply stands out above the rest. It's not just a pseudo SUV. It's a contemporary redesign that is redefining the CUV space. The Seltos is real-world ready for your daily life and your adventurous weekends. It's an SUV that leaves the competition behind in size, style, and strength. Find out more at your local Kia dealer today.
Welcome to Tech Stuff, a production from iHeartRadio. Hey there, and welcome to Tech Stuff. I'm your host, Jonathan Strickland. I'm an executive producer with iHeart Podcasts, and how the tech are you? So this past weekend, and I'm recording this June 12th, 2024, but this past weekend was the Summer Games Festival, which is kind of a marketing extravaganza for the video game industry. The festival has grown in importance, especially since the dissolution of E3, may it rest in peace. And while several of the big companies in the space now tend to hold their own events that are completely independent, the festival still remains a really important tool for tons of developers who might otherwise find it difficult to get their work showcased. But one thing I did not see during the festival was news on the long-awaited piece of retro hardware called the Intellivision Amico. And that reminded me that I've never really done an episode dedicated to Intellivision either. So we're going to address that today. And before I get to all of that, if you're really, really, really into Intellivision, well, chances are you already know about the Intellivisionaries podcast, which I have no connection to, by the way. But it's a show that has episodes that dive super duper deep. Deep down into all things in television. I listened to about a third of one episode in which they interviewed authors Braxton Soderman and Tom Belstorff. Those two wrote a book that's titled Intellivision: How a Video Game System Battled Atari and Almost Bankrupted Barbie. That book actually comes out later this year, so sadly, I wasn't able to use it for this episode. Maybe I'll reach out to them and we'll do an episode later in the year when the book comes out. But I really did listen to like a third of the episode they were on, because that interview is about an hour long, but the whole episode is 5.5 hours long. So y'all thought my shows get lengthy. I got nothing on the Intellivisionaries. Turns out, like, the more, I think, focused your podcast is, the longer the episodes tend to get. Anyway, for those of us of a certain age, the brand Intellivision conjures up memories of very early console wars, technically the second generation of video game consoles. So Intellivision, along with things like, I would say, Coleco and Atari would compete in the burgeoning home video game system market more than 40 years ago at this point. So let's talk about where Intellivision came from, what happened to it, and how recent efforts to resurrect it have encountered new road bumps along the way, as well as the tale of an old enemy coming back to pick over the bones of its former competitor, which is foreshadowing. So, let us set the scene. Now, before home video game consoles or video game arcades, there were nerdy computer science students. And these students were some of the only folks to have regular access to computers. Computers in those days were huge, they were expensive, they were super complicated. You know, a small computer might be the size of your typical refrigerator, and many of them were much, much bigger than that. And while the computers were meant to do all sorts of important number-crunching things, creative students would naturally begin to experiment with them in order to make them, you know, do other stuff, like games, for example. And so in the early days, and we're talking like the 1960s here, the only folks who even knew that video games could be a thing were college students working in computer labs. But eventually, these ideas were able to creep their way into the mainstream. Nolan Bushnell, whom we'll mention a few times in this episode because he did not work at Intellivision at all, he would be a co-founder of Atari, the other really huge, important video game console company in the late 70s, early 80s. And he took an idea that began in computer labs. It was a game that was called Space War. And he adapted this into a coin-operated arcade cabinet called Computer Space. This was back in 1971. However, this game failed to take the world by storm. It was a complicated game. It was very difficult. It did not get much traction, but it was a start. The first home video game console, at least this is what the general agreement is on, was the Magnavox Odyssey. This launched way back in September 1972, and it was Pong before there was a Pong. Quick side note, the aforementioned Nolan Bushnell, who again co-founded Atari, would actually assign his brand new engineer, Alan Alcorn, the job of building a table tennis arcade cabinet. So essentially what Bushnell did was he described to Alcorn all the elements of the table tennis game on the Odyssey. Like, he knew of that version, the home video game console version, but Alcorn had never seen it. He had never played that. And this was a test of Alcorn's abilities. He essentially said, hey, I need you to build this game. And he was able to describe specifically what he wanted because he was describing a game that already existed. It's just that Alcorn didn't know about that. And Bushnell claimed that this was all part of a contract job with General Electric, which turned out to be a total fabrication. So Alcorn took the assignment and eventually he made Pong. Pong ended up going on to be a huge hit arcade cabinet for the fledgling Atari company. In fact, you could argue it was the first like mega hit as far as arcade cabinets go. Anyway, my point is that the home video game console market got its start in the early 1970s. The Magnavox Odyssey was a dedicated console. Now that meant you could only play what had been hard-coded onto the console itself. The game was integrated into the consoles. There was no cartridge slot. There certainly wasn't something like an optical drive or anything like that. All of that would come on later. So in a way, it was sort of like those retro consoles that you sometimes find that have a limited library of games pre-programmed onto the device itself, right? Like there's some of those for the Atari 2600 or Nintendo Entertainment System or SNES. All of those old systems have like these dedicated retro consoles that have a limited library available on them. That's kind of what the first video game consoles were like, except the library often was just one game and it was just some variation of Pong. In 1976, the Fairchild Channel F console would introduce an innovation. It was a console that could accept ROM cartridges, and therefore it was not limited to games that had been hard-coded onto the console itself. ROM stands for read-only memory. That means the games were physically programmed on circuit boards and there was no way to write new information to the games themselves. The circuit boards had a little electrical contacts on them, and those contacts would connect to matching contacts in the console itself when you plug the cartridge in. That's what would complete the circuit. It would let you play whatever game had been programmed on the cartridge. While the Channel F hit the market months before Atari launched the 2600, initially called the Video Computer System, or VCS, Atari's library of games would have a much broader appeal than the Channel F's selection. The Atari 2600 became a really popular video game console, and there was a huge demand for the technology. Folks who worked at Atari began to enjoy a sort of rock and roll lifestyle as the money came flooding in. Seriously, if you read the articles about Atari in its early days, it comes across as a bit rock and roll. Probably not as wild and crazy as some of the articles indicate, but it certainly presages, I would say, the startup culture that we would associate with companies in like the late 1990s before the dot-com bubble burst. Of course, lots of companies wanted to cash in on this growing trend. You know, whether it was considered a fad or an actual trend at the time didn't matter. Companies saw that people were interested in video games, and they wanted to be able to get in on that. So some of the consoles that popped up in the mid to late 70s and into the early 80s were pretty much garbage. In fact, the number of consoles that essentially were just Pong clones created an unstable market, and consumers grew disenchanted with the limited offerings that these consoles made, and that some of them were just really poorly designed. Ultimately, this led to the first video game crash of the home video game console market. This happened in 1977. Now, when you hear me talk about the video game crash, typically what I'm referencing is a much larger market crash that happened in the United States in 1983. But the first generation of consoles had its own crash 6 years earlier. Again, these were for consoles that were mostly dedicated consoles or Pong clones. Anyway, there's overlap between the first generation of consoles and the second generation. It's not like we can just draw a line in years and say everything before this is first generation and everything after this is second generation. There was a lot more crossover than that. Really, when we say first generation and second generation, we're talking about a generation of consoles that were primarily dedicated systems where you could not change out what game you were playing. No, it was just limited to whatever was on the console itself. And the second generation would have more of the cartridge-based approach where you could buy different cartridges and thus you could accumulate a library of games. And, you know, playing a different game was as simple as turning the system off, pulling a cartridge out, putting a new one in, turning the system on again, and there you're ready to go. So there is overlap between those two generations. Atari would become the dominant company in this space, but there were quite a few other competitors that also stood out with systems that sometimes had features and functions that made them a more serious threat to Atari's dominance because the systems were more sophisticated and had, you know, a leg up in some technical aspect. But Atari had a really big head start, and that was a huge help because they were able to establish a pretty significant customer base early on, and that's invaluable. Well, one company that saw opportunity in the video game space was the giant toy company Mattel. So Mattel got started as a little home business made out of a garage way back in 1945. And originally Mattel made stuff like, you know, like dollhouse furniture and picture frames and that kind of thing. But in 1947, Mattel introduced a toy ukulele as a new product and then began to make toys more regularly. Things really got moving in 1959 with the introduction of a little toy called the Barbie doll. Hi, Barbie. That doll's massive success propelled Mattel into becoming a publicly traded company, and it really took off. And flush with cash from this IPO, Mattel started doing what a lot of other companies do when they get tons of money. It started to gobble up other toy companies left, right, and center. And not just toy companies. Mattel would also acquire everything from the Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey Circus to industrial companies specializing in everything from plastic production to die casting. So by the 1970s, Mattel was a really big deal, despite some missteps along the way. Like, there were some times where Mattel was in some financial trouble, but the company had managed to survive all of that. In the early to mid-1970s, Mattel leadership was reluctant to get into the video game console space. Because remember, in this time, the market's still very young, right? It's unproven. This is also really still the era of the first generation video game consoles. So Mattel executives weren't entirely sure that this was going to be a sustainable business. So it should come as no surprise that the company kind of held back at first. And to be totally fair to Mattel, the corporation had some rocky financial situations earlier that decade, so, you know, they were a little gun-shy as well. But then enter Richard Chang, Mattel's head of toy design and development. In the mid to late 1970s, he began considering the possibility of getting into home video games. There were some competing ideas within Mattel at the time. Some engineers wanted to focus on handheld games. These would be similar to the dedicated consoles in that they would have a game hard-coded onto the circuitry of the system itself. Others wanted to make an actual video game console for hooking up to your television. Ultimately, Mattel would do both, though at first the company would produce and release the handheld systems, while some within the company worked on what would become the Intellivision. Okay, we've got a lot more to this story, but before we get to that, let's take a quick break to thank our sponsors.
All right, quick switch, because I want to tell you about one of our favorite sponsors, Vital Proteins. But I can't really talk about Vital Proteins without talking about collagen first. So, did you know that collagen makes up 1/3 of all the protein in our bodies? That's a lot of collagen. But our natural collagen production starts to dip at age 30, give or take a few years. I'm currently pushing 40, so I know. So, adding collagen peptides feels like a really simple way to support what your body already does. Now, I know you've seen Vital Proteins collagen peptides iconic blue tub around before. It's literally everywhere. I mean, it's one of the most recognized collagen supplements out there. And there's a reason it's so popular. It supports healthy hair, skin, nails, bones, and joints. I mix it up with water, and I drink it first thing in the morning. And I like the way it makes me feel, sets me up for the day, and I think sets me up for better workouts too. And honestly, it just fits into my life. I'm betting it'll fit into yours too. You can add a serving to your morning coffee, your tea, smoothies, or oatmeal, into whatever you're already having, and it dissolves easily with a neutral taste, no extra steps. Like I said, it fits right into your life. People use it for different reasons, some for beauty benefits, some for joint support, but for me, it's all about building a daily habit that I can actually stick to. And that's the key with collagen peptides, consistency. One serving every day to support your hair, skin, nails, bones, and joints. And right now, you can get 20% off your next order by going to vitalproteins.com and using our promo code TechStuff20 at checkout. Huge thanks again to our sponsor, Vital Proteins. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. I want to tell you about Keeper Security, because unlike built-in password managers, Keeper works across platforms, which allows you to securely share information with your family, with your colleagues, with your friends. And I personally store things like passport and credit card details, so I'm not scrambling every time I travel, which makes my life more efficient. And when you're busy, but also focused on security, like I am, that is absolutely critical. Keeper is offering a 50% discount on personal or family subscriptions using the promo code TechStuff at keepersecurity.com at checkout. Your digital footprint is probably bigger than you think. A simple search can pull up your personal details, where you live, how to contact you, even past information, all from data broker websites. OneRep helps you take that back. They scan more than 878 data broker and people search sites, automatically remove your personal information, and continuously monitor for new exposures so it stays off. It's a privacy protection that keeps working in the background. Visit onerep.com and use code TechStuff to get up to 60% off any annual plan. Hey there, before this podcast continues, I need you to fill out 37 forms about your listening history. I'll wait. Just kidding, that would be ridiculous. Yet we all do it every time we need healthcare. But new Amazon Health AI is different. It can connect your health history to offer personalized care, so you can get help fast. Amazon Health AI. Healthcare just got less painful.
We're back. So Chang, the head of development over at Mattel's toy division, reached out to a company called APH Technology Consultants to help with the various video game projects within Mattel. And Mattel would actually spin up a kind of a subsidiary called Mattel Electronics to oversee this stuff. So this consulting group would ultimately do a lot of the programming for the handheld systems. Mattel worked with a company called General Instruments to tweak the design of a platform that General Instruments, or GI, had created called the Jiminy 6900. I guess it's Jiminy. It's spelled G-I-M-I-N-I. And I know that some astronauts referred to the Gemini spacecraft as the Jiminy spacecraft, so I'm guessing it's the same here. Anyway, the whole concept was to take this platform, this Jiminy 6900, and tweak it so that it would be easier for programmers to use the same basic foundation to program different games. That would speed things up and bring costs down. And GI was eager to do this because they saw this as an opportunity to really have a profitable business working in chips meant for specific applications like this. Mattel began to release the games, these handheld systems, and they did well. And this helped build some momentum toward pushing out a fully fledged home video game console system. So this was around 1978 or so. Atari had released the VCS in 1977. And the dates get a little fuzzy when I talk about this kind of stuff because, as it turns out, no one was really acting like an historian during the whole process. Like, that's true for a lot of the technologies that came out in the 70s and 80s. The documentation is limited. Sometimes it doesn't even exist, or no one knows about where it might exist because the companies responsible may have gone out of business decades ago. So the book I mentioned earlier in this episode, the one that was featured in that interview of the Epic podcast, that book isn't out yet. It comes out later this year, the fall of 2024. So I can't reference it, so I can't look to see what the more heavily researched bits actually say. Maybe, again, I'll revisit this when that book comes out to see if it clarifies things. But within Mattel, there was a guy named Dave Chandler, who also got the nickname Papa in Television, who led a team to develop the actual physical hardware. The software side went to the APH Technology Consultants Group, and the operating system for Intellivision would receive the codename The Executive, or sometimes The Exec. The team was sticking with General Instruments for the chipset that would ultimately be used within the Intellivision console. Reportedly, Texas Instruments at one point pushed to have Mattel jettison the GI chipset in favor of a chipset from Texas Instruments. But ultimately, Mattel stuck with their previous partner for those handheld systems, partly because changing course would have set the whole project back by at least half a year. And the home video game market was really getting red hot in the late 70s. So a six-month delay could have been very costly because who knew how long this video game fad would actually last? Well, the hardware was interesting, and Mattel would introduce some add-on components to make it even more interesting, and introduce or develop some that did not get widespread adoption, but probably would have made the system pretty incredible if Mattel had been able to get a handle on some very tough problems. But first off, the initial console bore at least some similarities to the early Atari 2600 console, complete with faux wood paneling on the edges because, well, because it was the 1970s and we were all crazy for wood paneling. I actually think it's pretty amazing that the Intellivision didn't also have orange-brown shag carpet on it, if I'm being honest. The controllers for the Intellivision were a major departure from the Atari 2600. So while the faux paneling made it kind of look a little bit like an Atari system, the controllers were their own thing. ColecoVision had its own controllers that were kind of similar, but Intellivision, man. So the Atari controller was just a basic joystick that had a single red button on it. The Atari 2600 joystick was digital, which meant moving the stick in one of the four primary directions would just complete a circuit and send a command to the console. It's not like you could press harder or softer to make your character move faster or slower. It was either moving that way or it wasn't. Now, you could also move the joystick on the diagonal and thus complete two points of contact. And that would allow the system to let you move characters on a diagonal path if the game supported that. So, which meant that ultimately with an Atari joystick, you had up to eight directions of movement possible. Now, the Intellivision controller looked kind of like a remote control with a direction pad disc that was set either above or below a number pad. Whether it was above or below depended upon the generation of controller you had. But yeah, think of like a remote control with a number pad that's three numbers wide. So you got the, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, maybe some other little command buttons. And then would have this disc either at the base or at the top. And the disc was a direction pad where you'd press on the edge of the disc and you could make stuff move that way. This had 16 different points of directional control. And the number pad meant that the Intellivision games could have a much more complicated interface than your basic Atari games. The pad itself, I would say, was a real thumb killer. It was just a circular disc and you would press along the edges to give commands to the game. You could eventually buy little joystick adapters that clipped on over that part of the controller. The joystick would just manipulate the disc underneath. That's actually how I played most of my Intellivision games, because otherwise my hands would really cramp up pretty fast just trying to manipulate the disc. Just holding the controller could be pretty uncomfortable. There were also, as I recall, buttons along one side of it, so that gave you some more input options. And it meant that you had to hold the controller a specific way, because the buttons would be inaccessible if you held the base of the controller, say, in your left hand instead of your right hand, which could be frustrating, if you weren't right-handed. It could be a little difficult. I'm not right-handed, so I guess what I'm saying is I've personally found it very difficult. But interestingly, because of that number pad, game developers could create little plastic overlays, and these overlays would slide into a slot on the face of your controller and would fit over the number pad. And the overlays could indicate to gamers what each button did if they did anything at all within the game. So rather than just having to remember that you would need to push, I'll give you a hypothetical. You needed to push the number 2 button to pull up an inventory or something like that. Instead of that, you would have this overlay and you would see like there'd be a little marking that represents inventory and it's over top the number 2, but it meant you didn't have to remember you needed to press number 2. You just pressed the picture that made it look like a backpack or whatever it might be. And so you could just look at the overlay to see what you needed to push in order to do a specific action within the game. Of course, each game would have its own overlay, which meant you had twice as many components you could misplace and thus make it hard or impossible to play the game. Because, obviously, if you misplace the cartridge, well, then you don't have a game to play. If you misplace the overlay, well, then you don't have the indicator for what the controller does, and you would be down to trial and error, and then you'd have to try and remember from that point forward. But still, the overlay thing was a really cool idea. It was a little challenging for folks like me because I inherited my Intellivision game system and all the games for it and all the overlays. And it meant that I had maybe overlays for about half the games that came with the box that I got. So I had overlays for games that were not in the box, but sounded really cool. Like, I'm like, oh man, I wish I had the game that went with this overlay. And then I also had games where there was no overlay whatsoever, or at least I didn't have the overlay. So whether one was never made or it was lost or whatever, I don't know. But still, I had an Intellivision, gosh darn it. So I guess I shouldn't, look a gift horse in the mouth or anything. The cartridge slot on the original Intellivision was on the right side of the system. So it wasn't in the top or the face of it. It was on the right side. And the cartridges themselves were narrower than Atari 2600 games. They also didn't have any artwork on the face of them. Like if you look at an old Atari 2600 game, a lot of them have this cool artwork on one side, as well as the title typically along the top of the cartridge. In television cartridges, you just had the title on the end, really. As I already mentioned, the APH consulting firm designed the operating system that would run on top of the hardware. They also, would provide the platform for developers who wanted to make games for the Intellivision. and the initial games for the Intellivision almost exclusively came from APH. Mattel did a kind of a soft launch for the system in Fresno, California in 1979 in order to judge how receptive consumers would be to a new video game console, because the Atari 2600 had been out for 2 years at this point. The Intellivision would initially retail for $299, which was more than $100 more expensive than the initial Atari 2600 cost when it launched 2 years earlier. So if we adjust for inflation, get ready for this one, y'all, it would mean that if you bought a brand new Intellivision in 1979, that would set you back the equivalent of around $1,200 in 2024. Like, it's the equivalent amount of buying power. So imagine going out and buying a video game console for $1,200. That really puts things in perspective, doesn't it? I mean, video game consoles are an absolute steal these days if you compare it to how much the old ones cost by taking buying power into consideration. In that initial launch, Mattel offered just 4 games. Again, this is a test market in Fresno, California. And those 4 games aren't exactly titles that you would expect to be a huge success. They were Math Fun, Armor Battle, Backgammon, and then Poker and Blackjack. So you've got 2 video game versions of card or board games. You've got 1 game that's desperately trying to convince you that math is in fact fun. And then you have a more standard video game in the form of Armor Battle. Now, remarkably, folks still found the system to be intriguing, and the response was enough to convince Mattel to push into mass production for a nationwide effort. One thing that would set Intellivision apart from Atari was the chipset in the Intellivision allowed for higher resolution graphics. Now, keep in mind, the graphics of Atari 2600 games were really primitive. So Intellivision, when you get down to it, was slightly less primitive. It's not like they were super high resolution games or something, but it was definitely an improvement over the Atari 2600. Mattel would brag that the characters in their games would actually have stuff like arms and legs, for example, which is not exactly a high bar to clear. The sound chip in the Intellivision was actually pretty limited to beeps and buzzes, but Mattel would develop and release some hardware that would improve things for specific titles. Again, the actual chips would come from General Instrument. GI had developed a voice synthesizer chip in the late 1970s. It was called the SP-0256. The team at Mattel, responsible for taking that chip from GI and then incorporating it into a module for the Intellivision, would include Ron Carlson, who led the hardware team, Ron Surratt, who was there to write software for this thing, and Patrick Jost to help with the voice analyzation and voice data for the games. The result was the IntelliVoice module. This was an add-on. It would plug into the cartridge slot on the right side of the Intellivision. On the right side of the module was another cartridge slot. That's where you'd put the relevant game so that you could get the synthesized voice action. And that module would come out in 1982, just a year before things would get really hairy for the entire home video game market in the U.S. Only a couple of games ever came out that supported this feature. Just 5 titles, in fact, came out that supported it. I owned one of them because the Intellivision I inherited also had the IntelliVoice module. And one of the games, notably B-17 Bomber, which I remember having a narrator with an over-the-top Southern accent, came with it. That accent, it would sound, I'll never forget this. I would boot up the game and the game would just spout off to me, B-17 Bomber. Like, it was way over the top, very slow. I think it was slow so that you could understand it more easily, because obviously it's like listening to someone speak through a vocoder. Like, it's really digitized and odd. But I thought it was pretty darn rad at the time. However, the IntelliVoice ultimately didn't sell very well, despite early excitement for the add-on. Perhaps part of the issue was the industry as a whole was rapidly approaching a precipice that ultimately it would plummet off of, and it was just bad timing. But it was also a really expensive add-on, right? And it was only working with a couple of games. It's not like somehow it retroactively gave better sound effects to all the games that were ever made for the Intellivision. It didn't. So maybe those were other strikes against it. Anyway, we're going to get back to the games. We got more to talk about with them and the fate of the Intellivision system and the brand. But before we get to all that, let's take another quick break to thank our sponsors.
All right, quick switch, because I want to tell you about one of our favorite sponsors, Vital Proteins. But I can't really talk about Vital Proteins without talking about collagen first. So did you know that collagen makes up 1/3 of all the protein in our bodies? That's a lot of collagen. But our natural collagen production starts to dip at age 30, give or take a few years. I'm currently pushing 40, so I know. So adding collagen peptides feels like a really simple way to support what your body already does. Now, I know you've seen Vital Proteins collagen peptides iconic blue tub around before. It's literally everywhere. I mean, it's one of the most recognized collagen supplements out there. And there's a reason it's so popular. It supports healthy hair, skin, nails, bones, and joints. I mix it up with water, and I drink it first thing in the morning. And I like the way it makes me feel, sets me up for the day, and I think sets me up for better workouts too. And honestly, it just fits into my life. I'm betting it will fit into yours too. You can add a serving to your morning coffee, your tea, smoothies, or oatmeal, into whatever you're already having, and it dissolves easily with a neutral taste, no extra steps. Like I said, it fits right into your life. People use it for different reasons, some for beauty benefits, some for joint support, but for me, it's all about building a daily habit that I can actually stick to. And that's the key with collagen peptides, consistency. One serving every day to support your hair, skin, nails, bones, and joints. And right now, you can get 20% off your next order by going to vitalproteins.com and using our promo code TECHSTUFF20 at checkout. Huge thanks again to our sponsor, Vital Proteins. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. I want to tell you about Keeper Security, because unlike built-in password managers, Keeper works across platforms, which allows you to securely share information with your family, with your colleagues, with your friends. And what I like about it is it goes beyond the walled gardens of Apple, Google, and Samsung so that everything is accessible regardless of what device you're on. Keeper Family allows you to extend this to partners and kids, making it easy to securely share important information. I personally store things like passport and credit card details, so I'm not scrambling every time I travel. And it's been a complete game changer storing and accessing passwords, which makes my life more efficient. And when you're busy but also focused on security, like I am, that is absolutely critical. Keeper is offering a 50% discount on personal or family subscriptions using the promo code TECHSTUFF at keepersecurity.com at checkout. Your digital footprint is probably bigger than you think. A simple search can pull up your personal details, where you live, how to contact you, even past information, all from data broker websites. OneRep helps you take that back. They scan more than 878 data broker and people search sites, automatically remove your personal information, and continuously monitor for new exposures so it stays off. It's a privacy protection that keeps working in the background. Visit OneRep.com and use code TECHSTUFF to get up to 60% off any annual plan. Hey there, before this podcast continues, I need you to fill out 37 forms about your listening history. I'll wait. Just kidding, that would be ridiculous. Yet we all do it every time we need healthcare. But new Amazon Health AI is different. It can connect your health history to offer personalized care, so you can get help fast. Amazon Health AI. Healthcare just got less painful.
So, Intellivision games, let's talk about them for a second, like how much they cost, because a new cartridge would typically cost around $39.95 or around $40 in the United States. So, that's less than what you would buy a AAA title for today, right? Like, you're talking about AAA titles, they're probably $60 or $70. However, that's before we adjust for inflation. And when we do that, $40 in 1980 would be close to spending around $147 on a new game today. Again, it puts things in perspective. And keep in mind, the Intellivision games, while really innovative at the time, I don't want to take anything away from the people who made these games because they were the foundation for everything that would follow. But those games would be considered almost too primitive to play by today's standards for a lot of gamers. And I say that as someone who actually really loves these games. Intellivision would sell well, but it wouldn't topple the dominant Atari 2600. They wouldn't come close. Also, Mattel executives realized that they could make more money if they brought more video game development in-house rather than outsourcing it to a consulting firm like APH. And to that end, Mattel assembled a team of programmers. They poached some of them from competing companies. That group included Don Daglow, John Soule, Rick Levine, and Keith Robinson. Robinson would oversee the group as manager. He would also become very important to the Intellivision brand later on. So Mattel would try to keep those names and identities under wraps. And the reason for it was because Atari was notorious for luring away talent, and Mattel did not want Atari to know who was developing games for the Intellivision. So the group was only referenced as the application software programmers until TV Guide published a piece about the group in 1982. The writer of that piece found the official terminology kind of stodgy and boring. So that writer renamed the developer team the Blue Sky Rangers, which is way more cool. I mean, it gives me kind of Disney vibes, but way more cool than application software programmers. And that nickname stuck. They became known as the Blue Sky Rangers. One thing Mattel planned and worked on, but it never got a nationwide release, was a keyboard peripheral for the Intellivision. And so the idea was that this would help turn the video game system into a, you know, somewhat primitive but working personal computer system. The keyboard module itself had an additional 8-bit 6502 processor built into it, and that would boost the Intellivision's processing capabilities. It would technically become a dual processor computer way back in the early 1980s. But the development of the keyboard was really difficult. It was hard to make something that was going to work with the base system and turn it into a computer. It was very hard to do it in a way that was going to be cost effective, because it was so expensive to produce that it would mean Mattel would have to charge a lot of money for this keyboard peripheral. In fact, ultimately, the company would offer the keyboard in a very, very small limited market for a whopping $600. $600 is twice as expensive as the base console when it first launched. And keep in mind, Mattel actually marked down the price of the Intellivision, you know, 6 months and a year after it came out. But when it first launched, it was $300. This keyboard peripheral was $600. And you could only find it for sale in a couple of cities in the United States. Like, I think one was, I want to say like New Orleans, and the other was Seattle or something. Otherwise, the only way to get it was to purchase it by mail order. You couldn't find it at your local, like, hobby store or whatever. This ambitious project, unsurprisingly, turned out to be a big failure. Like, part of it was that, you know, it's so expensive. Another part is that it just was impossible to find. And it's a shame that it failed, because who knows, maybe Intellivision might have weathered the video game crash of 1983 a little better if consumers had seen the system as a viable personal computer. That's how NES was able to convince toy stores to carry the Nintendo Entertainment System, because NES marketed it as a type of home computer system, not just a video game console. Because after the video game crash of 1983, toy retailers did not want to get back into video games, because it had been such a terrible experience at the end of the crash, when you had all this merchandise that wasn't moving, you were marking it down to practically nothing, and half the time you just had to throw it out, you never get your money back. So retailers did not want to deal with video games anymore. If Intellivision had been able to position itself as a computer system more than a video game system, then it might have had an easier time of it. But as it turned out, this keyboard peripheral was just too darn expensive, so it was not really a viable option. Mattel did produce a lot of games for the Intellivision. By the end of the system's life cycle, which actually extended beyond Mattel's operation of the brand, Intellivision would boast around 125 titles. Now, Intellivision didn't have the same number of licensed games that Atari did. That was a bit of a strike against the Intellivision system. Gamers wanted to be able to play their favorite arcade titles at home, and while that didn't always work out so well, see also the Atari 2600 version of Pac-Man, one of the worst games I ever owned, it still gave Atari a leg up on Intellivision, because Atari did have more licenses. That's not to say Mattel didn't secure a few licenses itself, it did, but a lot of the games that Intellivision produced were kind of like these independent titles, these original ideas. Original ideas are just harder to sell to gamers who were hoping to bring the arcade experience to their home. Mattel also produced a more compact, cheaper version of the Intellivision in early 1983, just as the whole market was starting to crumble. This was called the Intellivision 2, and it wasn't like a huge improvement over the Intellivision. It was really the same system, but with a few quality of life improvements, right? Like it had longer cords for the controller, so you didn't have to sit right next to the console. The original Intellivision, those cords were super short, so it's not like you could have the Intellivision sitting on a coffee table and you're kicking back on the couch. You'd be like hunched right up over top the system in order to play it. Well, Intellivision 2 improved that a little bit. It was also more compact, smaller, less expensive, but it also was not compatible with every game that had been made for the original Intellivision. And the reason for that turned out to be that Mattel had made some tweaks to the operating system, allegedly specifically so that they could prevent certain third-party games from operating on it, which is pretty darn sneaky, Mattel. The company had also started to ideate and engineer around actual updated versions of the hardware, like real successors to the original Intellivision. So an Intellivision 3 was in development, and also plans were in place for yet another console. It was codenamed Decade. It might have been the Intellivision 4, but the video game crash would sideline all of those plans. Interestingly, the Intellivision would technically survive the video game crash. In fact, it was the lone video game console for sale in the holiday season in 1984 here in the United States. It was the only one still being produced and sold in stores. All the other competitors had either completely gone out of business or they had changed their focus to some other technologies. But at that point, it wasn't Mattel calling the shots, because in 1984, Mattel actually shut down the Mattel Electronics division of the company and started to sell off assets. And one former marketing executive for Mattel, a guy named Terrence Valesky, formed a new company that was ultimately called INTV Corporation. He purchased the Intellivision IP from Mattel, so he got the brand and the technology and all the games and everything. And so INTV Corporation would take over the production and development of the Intellivision systems and brands. And so the console stayed in production, although now produced by INTV as opposed to Mattel. So it was doing so with a new corporate overlord. This meant the Intellivision would actually survive throughout the entire 1980s. But despite efforts to build out things that would allow Intellivision to continue beyond that, everything started to fizzle out right around 1990. Intellivision secured a deal with the World Book Encyclopedia to produce an educational system that was based off the Intellivision console, but that all kind of fell apart, and Intellivision or INTV Corporation and World Book would end up suing the pants off each other, proverbially speaking, and ultimately INTV Corporation would go into bankruptcy toward the end of 1990 and folded in 1991, partly as a result of these lawsuits. But even then, the Intellivision was only mostly dead. Keith Robinson, who was the former manager of the Blue Sky Rangers, actually obtained the rights to many of the Intellivision games that were made by his group in the mid-1990s. And in 1997, he started to make these games freely available with an MS-DOS-based emulator. Just quick side note, an emulator is a device or some software that copies or emulates some other system in order for you to be able to access software for that system on some other platform. Most of the time when I talk about video game emulators, I'm actually talking about stuff that has no official rights to emulate the other technologies. That's not the case here, which I think is pretty cool, because again, typically I'm talking about like things that are related to piracy. This isn't. So Robinson formed a company called Intellivision Productions to oversee these efforts. And in fact, at one point, Intellivision Productions even took steps to go into production with brand new Intellivision cartridges, some of which were games that had been through development but had never been released, and others that were brand new. So these would be new cartridges that would work on legacy Intellivision systems. Unfortunately, those efforts fizzled out, But it was cool that for a while it looked like an obsolete system was going to get a second retro life in the late 1990s. The Intellivision brand faded a bit further from memory in subsequent years, though occasionally titles would pop up in special deals or compilations for other platforms, things like, you know, like mobile devices or whatever. In 2014, a company called At Games Digital Media Incorporated licensed the Intellivision brand and released a dedicated console featuring around 60 titles. This console was called the Intellivision Flashback. So that was something that people could get. Again, one of those just little dedicated console retro systems. 4 years after that, in 2018, the video game composer Tommy Tallarico, whom I always think of back in the days of G4 TV, any of y'all who remember that cable channel, that short-lived cable channel, G4, I'm talking about the original G4 TV, not the reboot that also unfortunately had a fairly short life. Tommy Tallarico was a personality on that channel, but he also is a really prolific video game composer. Well, he announced in 2018 that he had purchased the rights to the Intellivision brand. Now, at this stage, Tallarico's plan was to develop a new video game console that was inspired by the Intellivision. This new console would be the Intellivision Amico, which I mentioned at the very top of this episode. The new company he created took the name Intellivision Entertainment. So initially, the hope was to bring this console to market in 2020. But then a whole bunch of stuff happened. You know, you had your typical delays and engineering challenges, but then you also had, I don't know, a global pandemic. Maybe you remember that. Anyway, the Amico would experience numerous delays until yet another seismic shift would hit the brand. Because on May 23rd of 2024, Atari SA acquired the rights to the Intellivision brand and library. Now, they did not buy the rights to the Amico console. That's still staying with Intellivision Entertainment, which is going to rename itself, and may have by the time I've recorded this episode. I didn't look into that to see if they had actually changed their name yet. But yeah, they're changing that name, and it won't be the Intellivision Amico anymore. But the plan is for the Amico to still come out, to still have games made for it, and also to license games from Intellivision. So you would still be able to get certain Intellivision titles on the Amico. But yeah, now Atari SA owns Intellivision. This seems like one of those kind of ironic ending type things where, you know, these former competitors are now part of the same company. But that doesn't really work because neither Atari SA is the same as the original Atari company in the 1980s, nor is the new Intellivision entertainment brand that was brought over to Atari SA. That's not directly related to Intellivision either. Like, yeah, it's the brand, it's the IP, but it's not all the people who put it together. So it's not quite the same thing. On paper, it seems like a delicious irony, but in reality, it's, you know, corporate maneuvering and acquisitions and divestments and all that mess. Nothing that's easy to actually outline. But still, interesting now that Atari owns the Intellivision IP. So how that's going to manifest, I don't know. Like, I don't know if we're going to start seeing re-releases of these classic Intellivision titles or another like attempt at creating a dedicated console that features some of the more popular titles. I would love to play the Intellivision Dungeons & Dragons title again. I really had a lot of fun playing with that when I was a kid, so I would love to have that go. I'm sure I could find it online. I wouldn't mind having a little dedicated console so I could try to relive my childhood and then within like 3 or 4 minutes turn it off and put it in the corner and never touch it again because the games are hard and I'm old. But anyway, that's an overview of the story of Intellivision. As I said, like, there's this full-length book that's coming out later this year. It's really expensive, too. When I looked on Amazon, like, pre-ordering it was like $60. So I'm guessing it's going to be used like a textbook or something, because at that price, that's a hefty price tag for a book. But maybe I'll reach out to the authors and see about having them on to talk about, in more detail, some of the stories about the development, because I'm sure there's lots of twists and turns and interesting decisions. I'm like, I didn't really touch on the corporate level of Mattel and what was going on there, because I didn't really look too deeply into that, but surely that played a part in these decisions as well. Anyway, I hope you enjoyed this episode, and I hope all of you are well, and I'll talk to you again really soon. Tech Stuff is an iHeartRadio production. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
I want to tell you about Keepr Security, because unlike built-in password managers, Keepr works across platforms, which allows you to securely share information with your family, with your colleagues, with your friends. And what I like about it is it goes beyond the walled gardens of Apple, Google, and Samsung so that everything is accessible regardless of what device you're on. Keepr Family allows you to extend this to partners and kids, making it easy to securely share important information. I personally store things like passport and credit card details, so I'm not scrambling every time I travel. And it's been a complete game changer storing and accessing passwords, which makes my life more efficient. And when you're busy but also focused on security, like I am, that is absolutely critical. Keepr is offering a 50% discount on personal or family subscriptions using the promo code TECHSTUFF at keeprsecurity.com at checkout. Your digital footprint is probably bigger than you think. A simple search can pull up your personal details, where you live, how to contact you, even past information, all from data broker websites. OneRep helps you take that back. They scan more than 878 data broker and people search sites, automatically remove your personal information, and continuously monitor for new exposures so it stays off. It's a privacy protection that keeps working in the background. Visit OneRep.com and use code TECHSTUFF to get up to 60% off any annual plan.
This show is brought to you by Our Family Wizard and Hello Divorce. You're wrapping up a meeting when your phone starts buzzing. It's your co-parent asking where you are, and that's when it hits you. The pickup time changed. The message got buried in a text thread, and your kid is waiting outside right now. You're frustrated before you even call back, and that's not who you want to be. Our Family Wizard gives both parents one shared calendar, every schedule change confirmed by both sides, messages and expenses in one place instead of scattered across texts and voicemails. For 25 years, more than a million co-parents have trusted Our Family Wizard to bring a little more calm to the chaos. Two platforms for life after divorce. Hello Divorce helps you through the divorce itself affordably, and Our Family Wizard carries the co-parenting that comes after. You've got enough on your plate. Let Our Family Wizard carry the day-to-day. Start risk-free at OurFamilyWizard.com/iHeart. Backed by a 30-day money-back guarantee. OurFamilyWizard.com/iHeart.
Hey guys, it's Dasha here. The World Cup brings cities to life. Streets buzzing, crowds gathering, every goal sparking celebration. Moments like this are impossible to miss, but some moments are so quiet. They slip right past us. Human trafficking affects real people across the U.S., and it often looks different from what we think. Some survivors cannot simply walk away or ask for help. So learn the signs. Break the silence. Visit bluecampaign.gov/worldcup.
This is an iHeart podcast. Guaranteed human.